like to have continued with our informational format today, but seeing that the witnesses have not arrived, I will recess the meeting for the purpose of calling Tom Holt to the stand at 4 o'clock. So I'll recess the committee till 4 o'clock. Thank you for being here, Tom. We're in recess. For a few minutes thereafter, we will call to the dais Tom Holt from Oregon State Pharmacists Association, get a pharmacy perspective on the House Audit Committee's recommendation, and then assuming that time allows, we will call the pharmaceutical industry representatives to the dais.
Thank you, sir.
Get real friendly with that.
How's that?
Perfect.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. I was hoping to be joined today by a couple of our people who I believe are en route. What I'd like to do today is, to kind of give our reaction, suggestions in terms of the report, but not go through it, the committee report, but not necessarily go through it blow by blow, but try to highlight areas where we think you can maximize cost savings and generate efficiencies. As we've talked about, the human consequences of what we've all been discussing are pretty large, and from our perspective, there's a responsibility here to maximize savings from whatever management actions can be taken so that we can minimize reductions of coverage and to the extent we can avoid them, avoid new revenues, realizing we may have to go there at some point. But first, we do everything we can from a management perspective.
Tom, is this someone you recognize?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, this is Mike Douglas from Mike's Medical Pharmacy in Newburgh,
okay.
Past president of our organization. The fee for a lot of what I'm going to talk about relates to the fee-for-service drug benefit. And I know we're discussing the idea of pulling things together or apart, but it's important to keep in mind that what we have in fee-for-service right now is essentially the last unmanaged drug benefit in this state. There are things that are done at the margins through prior authorizations. We have a limited preferred drug list. But in essence, a patient on the Oregon Health Plan in fee-for-service can get virtually any drug that they demand or that their prescriber chooses, which is often a function of the patient's demand or their willingness to be demanding. At a strategic level in terms of expenditures, it's not a great secret how you can really affect cost in any health plan. That's to move share to generic products or to more cost-efficient products versus whatever brand happens to come to mind to a prescriber. Private sector plans and Medicaid programs use a number of different strategies to accomplish that, and I won't dig too far into the details of that, but that's really the big picture thing to keep in mind. And I have included in our packet today a little fact sheet that we'll get to in a minute that outlines some of that. From our perspective, it's simply a matter of good stewardship of the taxpayer dollar to ensure that we maximize that benefit so that we can maximize the number of people covered. As I believe you're aware, Mr. Chair, along with the Chain Drugstore Association, we arranged for the University of Texas to do an analysis of actual Oregon data that's pretty current, where the opportunities are to generate some cost savings. I do have some preliminary, very high-level results from that. The report's not quite done, and our agreement is to provide the full report to OMAP first. But what I can tell you is a couple of big important numbers. The average cost in the Oregon Health Plan fee-for-service for an innovator brand drug, that is one for which there is not a generic alternative right now, is about $100. The cost for a brand off-patent drug, one which there are generic alternatives, is about $50. And then the cost on average for a generic drug in the Oregon Health Plan currently is something less than $18. While it's, and a little bit of the 80-20 rule applies, while about the dispensing rate in terms of generic versus brand is a little bit better than 50-50, the generic rate is, I think, 52-53%, something like that is what OMAP has previously released. The cost is about 20% for generics and about 80% on the branded products. So clearly moving people from a branded product to a generic product when it's appropriate clinically saves a lot of money and you get the same or outcome for the patient. The preliminary estimate from the University of Texas is that if we just were able to move people to generic products for those products that have been dispensed a brand where a generic is currently available, there's about a $15 million savings for the biennium there. Now, we have in current law, when the physician does not designate brand medically necessary, the pharmacy automatically changes over to generics. So the implication there is challenging through prior authorization or some other process the dispense as written where a generic is otherwise available. OMAP did it separately, did an analysis of Prozac recently, and they looked at the whole SSRI category of antidepressants, but just for Prozac, which went generic about a year ago, the estimated savings for the biennium in general funds to move those patients to Prozac or to fluoxetine, which is the generic for Prozac, is about $600,000 in general funds for a biennium. So it gives you just some idea of how significant the savings are, just taking advantage of what's already out there in the marketplace that really ought to be happening.
May I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Tom, why wouldn't a pharmacist, if they got a prescription for Prozac and it was an Oregon Health Plan patient, why wouldn't they automatically go to the generic?
Chair Westland, Representative Tomei, the only instance in which they would not go to the generic at this point would be if the physician has written brand medically necessary or words to that effect on the prescription. Unfortunately, that's still commonly the case in that particular product. If the physician or other prescriber does not say brand medically necessary, then by law, and it's the standard of practice, the pharmacy will change that product to the generic equivalent.
Thank you.
There are a number of ways to get to that point of making those switches when it's appropriate. You can use a prior authorization process, as I've mentioned, to ease the workload on that. Some of that can be automated through the third-party billing system so that once a person has gone through the process once, then the system would have that identified, so if they came back for a refill, you wouldn't have to go through it all over again a second time. A number of private plans use some kind of a generic incentive, so if the pharmacy reaches a certain threshold of generic dispensing, then they get a little higher dispensing fee, and so that gives the pharmacy some incentive to, you know, make that phone call that's necessary to get a physician to switch. And there are a number of ways to go at that. Some other issues that we think are worth exploring, some of these have been talked about previously. One is doing prior authorizations for patients once they have exceed a certain threshold of numbers of prescriptions. There are some studies that suggest that 9 is a good number, good threshold number to look at, and the reason for that is to look for duplicate therapies and things of that nature where you might be able to actually eliminate products that are being used that don't need to be used for that patient.
Excuse me, you mean 9 different products?
Yes. Disease management is another area that we haven't really explored at a practitioner level. Our disease management is kind of one of those terms that's in the eyes of the beholder. Our view of it is that sort of dial 1-800 disease management is not terribly effective. And where that has been tried, the numbers don't bear out. Where it has been practitioner-based, it can be highly effective. And just as an example, I included in your packet, this is a study that just came out in the, I just got it in my mailbox this last week from the Journal of the American Pharmaceutical Association. But this was a five-year study of diabetic employees of the city of Asheville, North Carolina. And while this is a little different animal than a Medicaid group, the approach is the same as what we would suggest. And what they generated there was a healthcare cost savings ranging from $1,200 to $1,800 per year, and other savings such as additional days at work and things of that nature of $18,000 annually. So
I will put into the record that that's authored. One of the authors is one of my ex-students, an ex-employee, an ex-colleague. I'm going to take some credit for that.
Thank you for sharing, Representative Greenlee.
I'm going to take some credit for that study.
I'm happy to hear that. So the big point being, this is something that we really ought to explore. The state of Iowa has done a statewide program that's been fairly successful in Medicaid.
When was that published?
This?
Yeah, 1927.
Just this month.
The 1927 ones are all ones I did.
Is that some of your later work?
Our suggestion as we go about reconstructing this program is that we give OMAP a directive in the interim to work out a small pilot project so we can construct something on the ground here in Oregon, pick a high-cost disease. Diabetes is a good target. Asthma is probably another good one. And get something working within our system and our way of doing things here and move forward and see what we can achieve. A couple of other things that have come up, particularly in terms of drugs, are our mail order and how we match the line to the drug therapy. Just briefly regarding mail order, our perspective is that mail order works well for some people, and they should be able to voluntarily select that if it works for them. The history on mail order in Medicaid programs is not particularly good. It's not a practice setting that's set up very well to deal with a population that tends to be fairly mobile, drop on and off plan a lot, and some of those kinds of issues. And Mike, I'm sure, can speak to this also, but, you know, when you start mixing or peeling out, the chronic medications for a patient from other medications that they need, they're not really getting the benefit that they ought to be able to get of a unified point of care. We think it's something that should be can be used rationally by really carefully choosing patients that it's appropriate for. And, yes, if they're stable in terms of their therapy and stable in terms of where they're living and they expect them to be on the plan for some time, then maybe that's a good candidate for mail order. In terms of the above the line, below the line, one tool that has been talked about in the past has been including a diagnosis code on the prescriptions. That's quite controversial. Our friends at the Medical Association pretty consistently have not been fond of that idea, I think it's fair to say, and they have their reasons for that. I'm not sure what other tools you might look at, but that's one. It may be worth reopening the discussion there. However, I would say before we get to the point of diagnosis codes on the prescription, a more immediate problem is that we don't currently get provider numbers on prescriptions, which is something to the degree we should, which causes a problem for the drug utilization review, so that OMAP cannot go back through. About 30% of the prescriptions come through without a provider ID, and that means that OMAP cannot go back and find out, well, who is this physician that prescribed X, or that or they see a prescribing pattern that looks out of line. They don't have any way to go back and do any education if they don't know who the providers are. So that's something that needs some work. Regarding some of the, like to move on to some of the systems issues that we've talked about in terms of, you know, do we carve in, carve out, what kind of mix of managed care do we have in the drug management? The first threshold idea was to have the drugs that are currently under managed care in the Oregon Health Plan carved out for purposes of state purchasing, but still have the management done by the capitated health plans. Assuming, and it may be a large assumption, that this would pass muster under the federal rebate law, that the state would still get the advantage of rebates with that group, which would be the only reason to do that. There are a number of pretty significant systems issues that would have to work through, and I just raise that as a caution. Unless you use a single PBM to administer the benefit for all people on the Oregon Health Plan, there would be some really significant issues of integrating the data so that the health plans that can track the drug therapies of their patients, and so OMAP can handle billing and rebates and things, and there are some very significant systems on the ground issues that would have to be resolved with that. At the other end of the scale, there's been some discussion about having the capitated health plans manage all of the drug benefit, aside from, I believe, the mental health drugs, which is sort of a whole other category to deal with. We do have some concerns around that, and again, we just want to raise these as concerns and questions, not as necessarily opposition to the idea, but just to ensure that you all have a clear understanding of some of the issues that we have encountered in that. First off, the current rules don't adequately address how to deal with the intermediaries between the fully capitated health plans and the pharmacies. We've had ongoing problems and recurrent problems of prompt payment, where some of the intermediaries they get a electronic transfer of funds from the health plan. Health plan's done their job. State's done its job of getting funds transferred. And then the intermediary turns it into a paper check and sits on it for 30 or 40 days. That causes a huge problem for the pharmacies, which have to pay their wholesalers every 2 weeks. And what happens then is you have a domino effect in that the pharmacy isn't able to pay their wholesaler every 2 weeks. Then the wholesaler can't give them as good a deal, and then they lose some of their margin on all of their purchases. Their percentages change with their wholesalers. So that's an issue that would need to be dealt with either in rule or whatever statutory changes we make. Second, there's some issues of benefits coordination. The pharmacy has to be sure that when a claim card is presented and the claim goes through with the payer, that that's a good claim because you're sending goods out the door that, you know, you've paid a good bit of money for. And we need to ensure that the eligibility and things are set up so that when someone comes in with an OHP managed care card, it's a good card and that benefit's going to be honored. And if there are issues with who is responsible for that benefit, that it doesn't necessarily come back to the pharmacy, but that we deal with it in some other way through the system. The other couple other points is that, you know, the fact that we have the fee-for-service system is a bit of a check and balance against sort of borderline abuse is probably too strong a word, but problems that arise for patients in the Oregon health plans in some times in terms of inappropriate restrictions on therapy. This has been an issue in particular in pain management in some areas of the state, and the fact that patients have had the ability to bail out to fee-for-service has helped them to get the care that they need to have. And if we don't have that ability to bail out of a managed care, then we'll need to have some careful rulemaking around how we handle, you know, sort of appeals, I guess would be a way of putting it, for the patient. And then also we suggest that we carefully consider the idea of maybe carving out the whole institutional pharmacy service from managed care. To a large degree, the institutional, that is the nursing home, foster home, assisted living type of patient, most of them are in fee-for-service. There are some that are under the managed care plans, but by and large, that's a fee-for-service type patient. It's a very highly specialized service. And within that scope of practice, the pharmacists have a tremendous amount more control over the ability to influence the product selection. So a lot of the management issues that you'd be looking for in a managed care plan there are being dealt with by the institutional pharmacies and the consultant pharmacists who basically write orders that the physician comes along and affirms for drug selection and dose and things like that. And then last, should go be mentioned that, you know, we would need to have capitation rates that are appropriate to provide adequate and fair reimbursement. Now, one of the issues related to this also is...
Talk about that for... you're talking about a capitation rate for pharmacists. How would you see that working?
Chair Westland, Representative Greenlick, what I was referring to is in the capitation rate for the managed care plans, there is an accounting by the actuary of part of that is for pharmacy, part of it is for physical health.
You weren't talking about providing pharmacy services independently from other services on a capitated basis.
Chair Westland, Representative Greenlick, no. That may well be worth exploring at some future time.
I thought you were moving ahead.
Yeah. I did work up a little bit of a... This is one of the issues here is... You know, a lot of this relates to the flow of rebates, and I provide you with a little chart that's just sort of an example of how the rebates flow on fee-for-service versus the managed care. And to be brief, the bottom line here is that if the drugs are all managed by managed care, you give up the right to the rebates, and then the question is, are you better off there? And we think the answer is probably not in terms of your ability to get rebate dollars. As the chart shows, what you have is if you start with, you know, $100 worth of product or $100 worth of payment to a capitated health plan, first you have to subtract out the rebate from that. The state currently gets about 18% in rebates. On the fee-for-service side, that means the state is then responsible for 40% as the state's share of the Medicaid cost of $82. Under the current capitated health plan system, say you have $100 that's allocated for drugs, there's no rebate subtraction from that, so the state's responsible for 40% of $100. If we assume that the capitated health plans are getting 6% or so rebates, I hear numbers ranging from 6 to 8%, but the point's still valid. Then, excuse me, got a frog in my throat. The state net cost is about $94, and you're responsible then for $37 and some change is the state share of that. So, on balance, you know, the way the state is going to maximize rebates is in a fee for service. Central management type of plan. Thank you, Rick.
$200 million glass of water, Tom. We've established a base here. If you'd like to pay more, that's okay. Yeah. Representative Green.
We have some small rebates.
Yeah, we have some rebates on that. So you might want to question, you know, the efficacy of our giving you that water.
This is an interesting table. And it deals with being sort of iso-quantitative. I mean, this says, here's how the rebates flow if there's no change. One of the interesting things about the Asheville abstract that you passed out was by proper disease management, what you read into that is the cost of prescriptions went up. And that was independent of whether they saved money per unit of prescription. The cost of prescriptions went up, but the cost of hospitals went down and the cost of lost work went down, and there are a variety of things that went down. And I mean, I always react to a table like this by saying, yeah, but wouldn't it be better to cut the units of drugs? And now you're presenting another alternative, which is, wouldn't it be better to increase the units of drugs and maybe increase the drug cost if you had a financing system that the savings could be realized. I know Jim will probably talk about this, but that's always the perspective of the pharmacy industry, is that sometimes spending more on drugs is very cost effective because it has offsets from other pieces. But if you don't have the financing mechanism tied together, you can't reap those savings that come from more effective use of pharmaceutical products. Could you comment with that in light of this table?
Well, that's a Chair Westland, Representative Greenlick.
First, I want a definition. ISO what?
Yeah. I'm sorry, sir. When I sit here, I sometimes feel like a professor rather than a representative. Yeah. Keeping quantities equal, you save money. I mean, that's what these tables assume, that there's no change in the use of drugs, where no change in the quantity of drugs. ISO.
ISO. What's the word?
ISO quantitative.
ISO quantitative.
I apologize for the use of that. I humbly apologize.
No, I wasn't asking for myself.
Representative Cruz isn't even in the room.
I was asking for Representative March.
Where I got into that problem with him the other day.
I mean...
he is in the room. See, I did it again. And I apologize again for using unnecessarily archaic and quaint terms to confuse the issue. But you use ISO quantitatively all the time. I know that.
It's
a framing term.
Chair Westland, Representative Greenlick.
No, it's ISO corn.
To your question about isolation of drug costs versus,
I'll do better, boss.
Versus looking at the whole pie of costs, I think we totally agree. I mean, in terms there can be very smart ways to spend money on drugs. One of the big issues, for example, is compliance. An astounding number of people do not comply with their drug therapy. And if you increase compliance, they're likely to get better outcomes, but of course you're going to spend more on drugs because they're actually taking them. So the point I was just trying to get at here is, the question has come up, all other things being equal, where are you better off in terms of rebate? If you had all, there would be some information integration issues involved, again, of allowing the managed care people to keep track of their patients' drug therapy in a cost-effective way. That clearly the state's purchasing power will be maximized in a totally fee-for-service system with the ability to have a strong preferred drug list and to maximize then negotiation for rebates and enhanced rebates. And that's really the point of the chart. But we totally agree with your point in terms of we really need to look at the whole pie of health care, and over time we hope move away from looking at things in individual silos.
I have a question. Tom, why is it that fee-for-service gives a greater rebate than under managed care?
Chair Westland, Representative Tomei, the Medicaid programs, one, are guaranteed to get, quote-unquote, best price. So that's one element, and the rebate system is a part of that. And the state, then, is a bigger purchaser than any one of our local plans would be. And so it just gets to be a numbers game of who's got the biggest pot and who's got the biggest leverage.
But if the state had a managed care program, the state could get the same rebate?
If the Chair Westland, Representative Tomei, if the state had everyone under single management, and one would assume then a single preferred drug list, the state is going to be able to maximize its rebates. If you have instead a number of different individual plans, each negotiating for their own rebates, those rebate dollars are going to be quite a bit smaller.
Right. Got it. Thank you.
Just the last thing I wanted to touch on, too, in relation to the managed care is, some states have gone down this road of putting everyone under managed care. Arizona is noted in particular as being a 100% managed care state. And my understanding is they're in the process of pulling back from that precisely because they see the ability to maximize their cost efficiency by getting enhanced rebates, by having their own preferred drug list and their own central PBM for the Medicaid program. And then the last thing I just wanted to touch on, as we've all talked about, and then I'll turn it over to Mike just to give you a little bit of perspective from a community provider standpoint, is all this is, you know, the success of all this is premised on adequate and fair reimbursement. The pharmacy network now is quite fragile, and you've all heard me say here and elsewhere that, you know, the pharmacy margins are quite narrow. The reimbursement rate that's set to take effect on May 1st is not one we would characterize as fair and adequate, but it is, you know, what we have encouraged providers to do at this point is to hang in there, because next biennium hopefully things will be better. And I think people by and large have done that. That cutting reimbursement doesn't do anything about drug cost trend. The way you affect drug cost trend, as Representative Greenlick pointed out, is by affecting utilization. And then I would just close with noting that, you know, over the last number of weeks, we've been able to work pretty closely with Lynn Reed and her staff at OMAP, and I wanted to take the opportunity to publicly thank her and her staff on the record for their willingness to sit down and work through these problems with us, because these are tough times, and we're all trying to help Oregon's neediest people, and they're doing good work over there.
Tom, that was very, I think, appropriate and very thoughtful of you, because Lynn and all the gang at OMAP have been burning the midnight oil, so thank you for your thank you. A couple questions. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, I'm confused about what you're saying about Arizona. They are currently 100% managed care. They're capitated, right? So it's managed care. So why is it they're now considering drugs for fee of service? I mean, don't they have a formulary?
Chair Westland, Representative Tomei, my understanding is that, you know, what each of the managed care plans that they have would have their own formulary. The reason that they're looking at going to a fee for service is so they could have a unified preferred.
So there's not just one managed care. They have a group of several different managed care.
Chair Westland, Representative Tomei, that's correct.
Mr. Bukovian.
Thank you. Tom, in your chart here, is dispensing fee factored into here as well? The difference between the plans?
Chair Westland, Rick, no. That is not in there. I just say, you know, if it's $100 that you're spending on drugs combined of rate and fee, then that's how it would play out.
Where is this cited from?
Chair Westland, Rick, I actually just did this morning after having a discussion with some of the OMAP staff, trying to get a better understanding of how the rebates work and flow, and thought it would be useful for us to have today.
Yeah, he spent all his day looking up ISO quantitative. He had barely enough time to do this.
I'll be glad to supply a thesaurus.
Representative Greenlink.
I'd like to follow up a little more on Representative Tomei's question, because there are two issues I think built into the assumption here. One is that for any quantity, the state will get the best rebate for things they are paying directly, as opposed to that same ISO quantitatively.
Work it into every sentence you can, buddy. I'm playing for all it's worth.
For the same quantity that a health fund. So, I mean, it isn't only the consolidation, it's that the federal regs create the model that the drug companies can't give anybody else a higher rebate than they're giving the state. That being the case, there's, I think, an assumption built into the committee's recommendations that it's possible to sort of create a virtual managed care piece for the drugs, that it's possible to get both the drug utilization benefits of managed care and the rebate benefits of a state direct purchase. And I wonder if you'd care to comment on the extent to which, you know, some of the physician directors have said that physicians have to have a direct financial stake in changing their behavior and some other things. And I wonder if you think that's required as well, or whether it is possible to get both the benefits of managed care on the behavioral side and the benefits of direct purchasing on the state side.
Chair Westland, Representative Greenlick, I think it's an excellent question, and probably one that ultimately CMS is going to deliver the answer on whether or not they will let us take this kind of an approach. Conventionally, they've said, well, if you either choose managed care or you choose fee-for-service, and for any group of people, and you can't do both. So this would be very different from what's done elsewhere. I would tend to agree that clearly prescribing patterns are more optimal when the prescribers have a stake in the outcome somehow financially. When prescribers either are rewarded or, as happens in private plans, sometimes penalized for being sort of outside the range of normal in their prescribing patterns, you know, they tend to think more about, well, is it worth having the argument with this patient because they want what they heard an ad about? That's one of the real key questions here.
If I may follow up, though. Let's say CMS says okay. Now the question is it really feasible?
Chair Wesslin, Representative Greenlick, well, I wish I knew. I think there are probably a fairly large number of sort of systems issues of how you deal with this in the billing system, how you deal with it in it's more of a data question than anything else, perhaps. And I don't have a good answer for you on that, but I suspect it's a great deal more complicated than most of us think it is, including me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Mike? Enter and sign in, please. Get real friendly with that microphone.
My name is Mike Douglas. I'm a pharmacy owner in Newburgh, Oregon. I own Mike's Medical Pharmacy, which is a small retail store. I've been there since 1970, and we fill a lot of prescriptions. We fill a lot of prescriptions for the Oregon Health Plan. And there's a couple of points that I would like to make. And the first one is that the Oregon Health Plan population is probably the most time-consuming group of patients that we deal with. And there's two groups. There's the young group, and there's a couple of subsets of that group, and there's the older group. And in our particular area, we were a farm community for years and years and years until Portland decided to move our direction. And many of the small farmers have lived way beyond their life expectancy, and of course beyond their money. And so consequently they've been caught up in running out of money as time has gone by, which means that they now are on the Oregon Health Plan. Some of them are in nursing homes. Some of them are still in their own homes. Some of them are in foster homes. This group of people, we have a lot of empathy for, especially my staff. Since I was born and raised in Newburgh, Oregon, most of them are parents of people that I went to school with, people that I've known for all my life. And their care is really important to me as a pharmacist. And if I didn't enjoy doing that, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing, because the reimbursement for that kind of work, if you took it, you know, with all the services included, you'd be probably losing money, because a lot of it's late night stuff and that sort of thing. But these people are in a situation where if we can keep them in their homes, you know, we have a better chance of at least saving the state of Oregon some money, quite a bit of money, by the way. The younger set is a real mobile group of people who go to many different doctors and go to many different pharmacies, and they create many different headaches for not only the physicians but the pharmacists and the Oregon Health Plan people, too. We get reports back that says, you know, such and such went to seven different pharmacies, and this is a DUR report that we get. And these are the people who feel like the state of Oregon owes them something, I guess, because, and I was telling Tom today, I had one that came in, and she demanded to have trade name Tylenol number 3. She said that, you know, I'll sue you if you don't do it. First of all, I don't have time to, you know, sit there and argue with her. The second thing is that, you know, strangling somebody in your store is not necessarily a good idea, because who pays for it ultimately? You know, the people sitting in this room are the ones who pay for it. But they are the most demanding of the entire group. I have a little less patience, I will say, with them than I do with the elderly. Not that all of them are that way, but there's a fair number that are. And what it does to us is, just like when they cut the reimbursements and that sort of thing, your first thought is, and I've had this discussion with many of my peers, is, crimey sakes, I'm beating my brains out. And the people who really deserve the help, the people who really need the help, are the ones that are going to be hurt. The younger ones, the ones who are mobile, you know, they'll just go to, you know, they'll go to Rite Aid, they'll go to wherever, you know, whoever will take care of them. And I feel like a traitor, and I'm put in a position of being like a traitor. And I know, in looking at the system that we have in place in the state of Oregon, that we are about 20 light years behind. Everybody that I deal with, Sisters of Providence, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Med Impact, all these people have formularies, and they have a step system that you go through. You start out with the least expensive and try to, you know, make it work. If it doesn't work, you go to the next step. And there's not a pharmacist that I know of who isn't willing to go through those steps. You know, if Mrs. Jones is in one of my nursing homes and she's not getting blood pressure relief from Atenolol and she needs to go to something else, that's fine. But at least we tried the least expensive first, and then we go to the second step. And we become interactive with the physicians, and the question was, well, can you make physicians change? You can make physicians change if you threaten to kill them. That's one way. Or the other way is that you take away their money. Those are the two things that work. Neither one are really, you know, one is illegal and the other one is hard to do. However, the younger physicians who now are employees rather than being private practitioners are a little more understanding than some of the older physicians who have had private practices and are really involved in whether the dollars and cents make sense. Now we have managers in Sisters of Providence clinics around us who are begging us to step in and work with the physicians for better outcomes. I'll give you one example, and that is I have a diabetic who's on the Oregon Health Plan. This diabetic is he's not a real problem. In fact, he's a really nice guy. He's afraid that he's spending more money for the system than he should. So what does he do? He doesn't take his insulin. He doesn't take his medications. He doesn't eat right. What does he do right? He's a nice guy. We've been dealing with this fella for, I don't know, 5 years now. He's had one amputation, 3 heart attacks. He's been in the hospital every month for the last 2 years. Today, he's in the hospital because he's probably going to lose his other leg. Now, an intervention may mean with him cutting down the number of trips to the hospital by 1 or maybe 2. And maybe that's $20,000. Maybe that's more than that. Losing a leg, how much does it cost for leg surgery? I have no idea. But these are the kinds of interventions that pharmacists would gladly make if we were given the opportunity to do so. It does take some time. You have to sit down with these people, and you have to explain to them on a real basis what it means when your blood sugars are 300. That means that eventually you're going to go blind, you're going to lose your legs. That's just what happens with the disease. And here this person is, he's too proud to say, okay, I'm going to follow your recommendations because guess what? I'm spending too much money for my insulin.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
So, Mike, are you saying that a physician has not sat down and had that conversation with him?
Chairman Westland, Representative Tomei. But physicians have 8 minutes and 32 seconds in the Providence system to do what they need to do. Now, time beyond that becomes a problem because we have patients scheduled every about 12 minutes. Okay? So what happens is this patient comes in, he's not doing it, the things he should do, the physician says to him, you're not doing what you need to be doing, and you're spending, you need to talk to your family about your diet. That's the first thing they usually say. And then the second thing is are you using your insulin? Do they bring in the little booklets where they keep track? No, they do not. And the reason is because they don't have time to talk about that sort of thing.
But they have time to cut off his leg.
And that's the truth. And that's the sad part. And that's where we are in this whole deal. So what happens is that this physician now is an employee physician of a health group, okay? So if he sees, like, I had a physician who has left the state of Oregon because he had four AIDS patients. And four AIDS patients take a great deal of time. And he was reprimanded for taking so much time because the patients he had were very, very ill. Their thing is not built in where they say, oh, well, you're taking care of four AIDS patients, you know, we'll give you more time. That's not the way the bean counters look at that. They look at it simply by saying, you have 8 minutes and 30 seconds per appointment, and it'll be 12 minutes probably by the time you're done, and the next patient's on their way. And that's the reality of it. And they will see patients from 8 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night, and then they go to the hospital, and then they go home.
Could I comment?
Representative, please.
I think the picture you point is a little bleak, but the ultimate point is the important one. I mean, I would say in that case probably the physician has in the last couple of years spent 25 or 30 minutes
probably
in a frustrated conversation with that patient, not having the tools to really do something, may even have referred the patient to a health educator. But the difference between what you're talking about and this is that it's very hard in the healthcare system for somebody to have the ongoing constant feedback. And that's one thing that you, as a pharmacist, have the advantage.
Correct.
Because you see that person over and over. It gives you a chance to reinforce that. Yep. You may even have a quiet moment where you can spend a little more time with the patient. And we have tried to recreate that reinforcement in various healthcare systems. And it's been very hard to do because it isn't only the physician. So it isn't that the physician really didn't try and do it. It's that they don't have the tools to do it.
Representative Westland and Representative Greenlee, what happens is that these people can only see a physician so many times a year also. There's a limit. Now, if they have an emergency, they can see the physician. However, they may not see the same physician. There's a group of physicians. Whoever's the least busy may see him. So really the follow-up becomes really difficult. We see him, you know, sometimes every day. And we have a greater chance for making an impact on these people than the physician does. And some of the physicians will say to us, okay, you know, we're having a tough time. We had a diabetic patient. We couldn't figure out why she kept ending up in the hospital. Her blood sugars were like 600 and 700. She'd go to the hospital for 2 or 3 days, it'd come back down, and then all of a sudden go back up. Her husband was bringing her honey, and she was, because it was natural, she was always using honey. And these aren't just horror stories. These are daily things that go on. And you know, you think you've covered all the bases, and all of a sudden you get hit with something like this. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that the system we have is broken, and we need to do some things that are creative. Maybe we need to try some interventions by pharmacists on people who have a large number of drugs. For instance, in the nursing homes, I have 5 nursing homes that I do, and if they get over 8 prescriptions, I mean, we're sitting down and we're going through it on a real strict basis, trying to figure out exactly
8 different products.
They have 8 different products. Now, 2 of them might be laxatives. So you might only have six, but the reality of it is that once you start getting, you know, past eight, all the reactions are sitting there looking you in the face, and the actions now become secondary because we're making them sicker than we are making them well. And I'm in the business to sell pharmaceuticals, but guess what? There is a point of no return, and I think the group that really, really needs the help is the group in the Oregon Health Plan because they need the education, number one, and number two, they have more time to be in physicians' office, especially the young ones, and we need to bring this under control, and we need to make the younger group responsible, and we need to take the responsibility for the older group who can't do much about it. And I think if we do that, the savings that we have by putting them in, say, a foster home instead of a nursing home is incredible. And there are people that we can make a difference with. And it's real frustrating. I don't have many years left. I'll be in the nursing home probably in the next few years. But the reality of it is that it's time that we, in the state of Oregon, we as a practitioners in pharmacy, we as just human beings, recognize the fact that we can't be all things to all people, but we have to kind of crawl out of the box a little bit, take a look at some new things, and try to do it creatively. And I think we're starting. We're doing the things that we never have done before. We're looking outside of the box a little bit. We're saying, well, maybe we can do this. And I think reality is that we have to do that. We're at the point now where we're in trouble. And that's how we got here, because we tried to do all things and be all things to all people. And it's broken, and we can't fix it. We have to change it. And that's not easy. That's not an easy thing. And I know the pharmacists in the state of Oregon are willing to step up and say, if we can help you, you know, we will do it. We're ready. And I know the physicians are in the same situation. The nursing home administrators, they, you know, they're willing. Everybody's willing. It's just we have to start. And once we start as a team, and that's what we are, we'll have to be a team. The nurses have to be a team member. The pharmacists have to be a team member. The physicians have to be a team member. The legislature has to be a team member. Then we can solve the problem. But if we have one person trying to fix it, we're doomed to failure. We'll look like Saddam Hussein. We'll get beat up.
Very good.
I like the team part of that. Representative Greenwood.
Mike, I spent several years as a community pharmacist before I decided to give up honest working, go into research.
That's what's the matter with him, Mike.
I know.
It's kind of picture. And I spent most of my life in those days in community pharmacies, where I really did know everybody, and there was a few minutes to schmooze once in a while, things were going on. Is a model you portray really possible in a Walgreens, Rite Aid, in a world that's becoming more and more consolidated with those guys behind that barrier and that high-pressure practice?
Chairman Westland, Representative Greenlee, here's the thing. And this I truly believe. I'm on the National Advisor for Good Neighbor Pharmacy. What we basically are, we're the Ace Hardware of pharmacy. We're independent owners, but we banded together for purchasing and that type of thing. I honestly believe that if we do it in independent pharmacies and we're successful, some of the chains are going to start doing it, and the pressure starts to mount. Because all of a sudden, the Costco's and the Walmart's and the Walgreens and those people are gonna say, wait a minute. If we're gonna stay in this business, and some of them may not stay in it, Safeway may not stay in it because it gets pretty tough. They may have to say, okay, are we in here as robots filling prescriptions, or are we in here as healthcare providers? And once they make that determination, they'll either have to get out or get in. And I think we saw a few years ago where a group of us started giving flu shots in our pharmacies. All of a sudden, Fred Meyer started giving flu shots in their pharmacies. And I think the thing is that if we promote pharmacy as pharmacy, then we have a chance for that to happen. Now, will it happen in all states? I don't care about other states. I care about the state of Oregon. This is my home. This is, you know, if I can make a little bit of difference, and this much is a little bit of difference, if I can make that much difference in the way we do business as, you know, at the state level, I'm for it. And I think that, yeah, I think pressure mounts and people start looking out, and chains are going to either, they're either going to get in or they're going to get out. And, you know, some of them are getting out. I'm right. Who knows what's going to happen to them? They have not changed in the way, their philosophy for doing things. And I think people, by and large, non-Medicaid people, for sure, are tired of going in and having, being a number and nobody talking to them and greeting them. And I know almost every patient I have by their first name. And I know their kids and I know their grandparents. And, you know, I mean, that's just the way we, that's the way we are. But see, we don't have the old family practice physician who used to deliver babies in houses and make house calls and all that sort of thing, you know, and where people cared for people. Now what we have, you know, I guess I can sum it up with one word: we're in the people business. That's what we're in.
Very good. Good.
Yeah, very quickly, two is Ned still operating in Newburgh, and is what's the kind of percentage of patients with eight or more drugs?
In the elderly, it's probably 30 to 40%. What was the first question?
Ned's long.
Ned is still operating in Uber. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going there next week.
Some things never change.
Just visiting, I hope.
Any other questions for our distinguished and informative panel from the pharmacists? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair would like to call a dais from the pharmaceutical industry to get their perspective on the House Audit Committee report. Don Stetcher, Jim Gardner. Russ, do you want to come?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, and we apologize for a delay getting into the committee before, so ask this chair's indulgence as we go forward, and we'll cover it as quickly as we can. With the chair's approval, I would suggest that I would like to go through the document in terms of the commentary on the recommendations, and if there are additional questions, Mr. Stetcher, our new task force chair, would also be available for answers if I'm unable to answer them. The general disclaimer that I want to make is that as the proposals evolve and take specific form, we of course want to be alert to the details of them, and so the statements that I'm going to make are with that cautionary note that it is obviously subject to looking at the fine print of in all of the items. The Tier 1 actions and the carve-out, I want to give a little bit of history of this issue, because this is something that we actively discussed with Dr. Santa and the group that he had put together in the run-up to the 2001 session. And it was a very kind of interesting issue, because what we discovered was that in the way that the capitation rate, the pharmaceutical portion of the capitation rate that had been computed by Price Waterhouse, was on the basis of billings from pharmacies to plans, billings, raw billings. And what was not being netted out in that exercise was the rebates that the plans were receiving from our companies. So for whatever reason, and I think part of the reason that arrangement was allowed to go on for years was that it was a kind of a rough way of making up for what was viewed as inadequate compensation on the hospital and physician portion of the cap rate. But nonetheless, it brought to the fore the very stark opportunity of carving out 100% of the pharmaceutical benefit and thus giving the state the federally mandated rebate that has been discussed previously. Now, that foundered on a reluctance at the time of the plans to go along with that for understandable reasons. And they were also concerned that not only would they be losing those rebates, but they would also be losing the administrative fee that went along with that. So they were kind of losing twice. I think that to their great credit, this time around, the plans have been willing to step forward and say that's okay as long as you give us the administrative fee, you know, to pay us for administering it. So that's my hats are off, frankly, to the health plans for really being willing to do that. We had come up with this this idea going into the 2001 session and discussed it with the group, and I think it's I'm glad to see it's on the table. It means it will cost us as companies more money, but it's money that the state needs, and it's money that we can it's one way of helping to structure a system that will benefit the state. There are, as I think was alluded to in the testimony, there are some gray area Medicaid law issues here. We think it will work, but we're really not sure, and we won't be sure until, you know, CMS at some point looks at it. It may be, it's probably in our view 1115 waivable, but we're just going to have to feel our way. But it's certainly worth a very aggressive try. And I think the other area is the continuing willingness of the fully capitated plans to play on this kind of playing field. I'm hopeful that they will, and they seem to be. But I think that there may be some fallout, at least among some of them. The second issue, and this is worth a lot of money. The carve outs is a good chunk of change, so that's definitely item one in terms of at least our recommendation of where to go. Group purchasing, multi-state.
Can I ask a question?
Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, the same question I asked Tom before. Do you think it's feasible to link those without that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, we think so. I mean, it's going to take, I think, some creative management, but we think so. But we'll have to find out. I mean, but the money is enough that it's worth trying. Group purchasing, et cetera. I've said before, I mean, we would not and could not argue that the state shouldn't be as prudent a purchaser as possible under its procurement authority. We believe that it already has very ample authority to engage in whatever kind of group purchasing is beneficial to the state. There is another bill going through right now, a generic bill, if you will, a generic DAS bill, which explicitly allows multi-state purchasing for all products and services. But I mean, there's we couldn't and wouldn't object to anything that the state to the state becoming a good prudent purchaser and a better prudent purchaser.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cruz,
is there an advantage to being multi-state rather than, I mean, do we get better rebate multi-state than we do just as Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I don't think I could answer that question in the abstract. I just don't know. There are pools that exist now. I believe Minnesota has a pool,
which we're part of.
Yeah, and I think some agencies, but not all agencies, utilize that pool. I don't think there's any barrier to more agencies using it, but I don't know. I haven't, you know, done a comparison of what the advantages, the prices are on that pool versus others. But I'm sure DAS is in a position to do that.
But just follow up. Aren't we federally statutorily entitled to get the lowest transacted price to a public entity?
Mr. Chair, yes, if you are the purchaser. Yeah,
for the same quantity.
Mr. Chair, if that's the Medicaid purchases, but you make other kinds of purchases.
Yeah, but we're speaking Medicaid in this instance.
Yeah.
So,
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, yeah, I don't think on the Medicaid side that the group purchasing will yield you additional savings, but it could on other agencies.
Right.
Is it not true that that's the lowest price for the same quantity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenland.
For your information, Don is shaking his head like.
Yeah, I don't. That's a question that perhaps we could.
And Don, I see you writing these questions down, so if you could get back to us or get some information on that through the committee, because we've been wrestling with this. We hear three different things, you know, after we ask two different types of questions, so we could flesh that out. I mean, we are primarily concerned about, obviously, Medicaid drugs, but if there's a way that can be pooled, you know, to lower, and Medicare doesn't have it. But
yeah, I mean, for example, one of the fears of going into Minnesota, which isn't Medicaid, is that we may actually be worse off on the Medicaid side by that pooling than we are just being as a state in the pure Medicaid purchase. So, is that understandable, Mr. Stetcher? Okay. Here's the thing. We're already part of the Minnesota multi-state for our institutions. Okay, so we get whatever rebate we get based on volume there. When looking into going into that for Medicaid, then it becomes part of a bigger group and we won't get the Medicaid rebate because there's non-Medicaid dollars in there. And so I think we would be worse off than keeping Medicaid as a separate carve out for a separate PBM.
Chair Westland, Representative Cruz, my name is Don Stetcher. I'm Associate Director of Government Affairs for Novartis Pharmaceuticals and also the State Chair for Pharma. My understanding is that right now, every state in the country gets the very best price that we give to anyone. Minnesota multi-state purchasing does not have a better price than any Medicaid department. And
okay.
It is also, Representative Greenlick, as I understand, not affected by volume. My understanding is that Medicaid gets the best price, period.
For the first 100, huh?
That's not my understanding.
I think it depends on who's doing the purchasing, but
I'm talking about the direct purchases.
Okay.
As well.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to point out that Mr. Stetcher is one of only two people on this planet I know that got hurt playing golf.
10% permanent disability.
That was really a good walk spoiled.
Occupational hazard.
Yeah, it's workers' comp claim. If you could flesh that out for us just so we could better understand, and I think Representative Cruz got the question out, so that would help.
There's also the special pricing, is there not, on the direct institutions, I mean, the 3245 or something, I don't know what that number is on the community institutions. Other things.
I'm not sure about that. We can look into that also.
Federal price.
I mean, veterans get a better price.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, that's our understanding, yes.
So if you could just get us a little white paper, bullet point, single syllable words, you know, talk about these different pricing opportunities, we'd really appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
Please continue.
Okay. Then going on to the next item, which is the management of non-mental health fee-for-service drugs by fully capitated health plans. This is where we start to fall off the boat here, and it's an important distinction that I want to try to be as clear as possible about. We have never objected to fully capitated health plans having their own management tools for their own population. And if the state were to see fit to expand the use of fully capitated approach to more, or all, that's great. Have at it. It's contrary to common misconceptions. We believe in managed care. And the reason we believe what is important is that you have the risk in one place so that that MCO can make a self-interested and well-informed decision to trade off pharmaceutical expenditures, to avoid hospital expenditures, to avoid physician expenditures, et cetera. The risk resides in one spot. But if you don't do that, if you have, for instance, the fully capitated plans acting as essentially little PBMs, mini PBMs, but not responsible for the medical and hospital risk, their incentive is very different. Then it is a sort of silo incentive to clamp down on that one category of expenditures, and if it's going to result in more hospitalization, more physician, not their problem. So that's the really the principle that we think is important to adhere to is having, if you're going to use a managed care approach, having it be real managed care so that the risk exists in one particular spot. And that's a sort of a lead into the kind of answer to the often asked questions, why does pharma oppose closed formularies and prior authorization in the fee-for-service Medicaid setting when every fully capitated HMO on the face of the planet uses these management tools, which, by the way, they're now moving away for and more toward tiering of copays. But the reason is that the state, when it, and I had this conversation a couple of years ago with a state employee who is now retired and who shall remain nameless, and I showed
120% of
the right. I showed him what was then the kind of the state of the art study on the effect of undue restrictions on formularies. It was the Horn study. It appeared in the Journal of Managed Care, and it was funded equally by our industry and by large HMOs. And the study showed that the more you clamp down on, more restrictive you make the formulary side, the more those costs pop out and get magnified on physician and outpatient and hospitalization. And this gentleman said, I believe that. I think that's probably right. It's kind of a behavioral offset issue that we were discussing before. Yeah, that's right. I said, well, then why are you pushing this kind of restriction? He said, that's not my budget. And that's the problem. It's the silo mentality, and that's the distinction that I think it's a principled distinction that we draw.
Just to reiterate, you start to say this is where we start to fall off the boat, and I don't know what your understanding is or what boats are falling off of, but what the report sent out and what we all put down in writing, and I don't remember if we signed the letter or not, but hopefully when this is all said and done, if the report is adopted, the fee-for-service population, at least 95% of them, will go into managed care, and they will present a card not similar to, exactly the same, because they will be members of an enrolled managed care plan that will be your key point, why managed care works, be responsible for the risk of that patient.
Mr. Chair, that's wonderful. I mean, that's always been the vision of the Oregon Health Plan. And
I think we'll get there this time.
Yeah. So, anyway, we've had this conversation. I've had it with Russ. I've had it with Ann. Had it with you. And I know you guys expressed concern. But, no, that's the direction we're going.
That's great. Hard edits. AKA prior authorization for a prescription above a specified number for a single patient within a specified period. This was one of our ideas last session. It was codified in House Bill 2497. We worked it out with that little group that Jackie put together. The bill was unfortunately vetoed, and curiously, Dr. Kitzhaber expressed concern about the adverse impact on Medicaid patients of prior authorization. This is the kind of prior authorization or hard edit that is actually beneficial to the patient. Because, as Tom was just testifying, once you get above a certain threshold, and we could debate where that is it 9, is it 15, somewhere in there, you start increasing geometrically the potential for drug-drug interaction. And therefore, you want to get in there and see what's going on with those patients. Are they drug seekers? Are they simply going to different physicians and different pharmacists?
It
can be a very dangerous situation, Mr. Chair. And so it's a, this is a, this one, it, not only because it will save money, because we think this will actually really significantly benefit patient welfare. It's a very important one. Audit the state's PBM? Sure, why not? And I, while you're at it, it might be not bad to audit the auditor, Price Waterhouse. I mean, this is the firm, after all, that had missed these rebates for all the years for whatever reason. Tier 2 action. Use the PA to enforce the PDL established pursuant to Senate Bill 819. This is proposed in an administrative rule to be heard on April 21st, and we think this is a fairly flagrant violation of legislative intent and is not lawful. The Attorney General apparently disagrees with us, but we have not seen, we've yet to see that opinion.
Could you translate?
Okay.
PDL and
I'm sorry.
PDP.
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Greenick, I'm sorry. Prior authorization to enforce the preferred drug list established pursuant to Senate Bill 819's prescriber-managed prescription drug plan. That was the bill that was enacted at the very end of last session. And a key component of that bill was a provision that some of us like to call the Physician Charter of Freedom, which basically allows the physician to select drugs other than the drugs on the preferred drug list by simply noting a dispense as written or do not substitute.
I remember saying something about that on the floor when I carried the bill. But
yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, that is correct.
Okay.
We think that the legitimate purpose of our existing prior authorization law is very clear, and it is to ensure clinical appropriateness. In other words, if there is a pattern that has developed of inappropriate use of particular medications, that's what the existing prior authorization law is intended to accomplish. It was never intended to accomplish to sort of herd people toward a particular preferred drug list. Just if I can beg the chair's indulgence, just a bit of specificity in terms of why that is a problem here. When Senate Bill 819 was fashioned, the idea was to make sure that the drugs that appeared on the preferred drug list were the therapeutically best drugs then obtained at the best possible price. That was the goal. A two-part process where you were supposed to figure out what were the most effective drugs and then how to get them at the best possible price. Well, what in three of the four classes of drugs that were first analyzed by the Health Resources Commission, what we had was an explicit finding that there was a lack of evidence of differential clinical effectiveness of the various drugs in these therapeutic classes. And what OMAP did was essentially to turn that into the exactly opposite conclusion, which was a purported finding that there is evidence of a lack of differential clinical effectiveness, which we think is kind of flipping the process on its head. In other words, they said, we can't find any evidence about, you know, which one of these drugs is better or worse or whatever. We just can't find it. It's not in the literature. And what OMAP said, well, that means they're all the same. No, it doesn't mean they're all the same. It means that it's as if Consumer Reports had set out to compare Chevys and Fords and said, we can't find any evidence. There's no studies out there about their brakes that are, and so therefore we're going to conclude they're all the same. No, what it means is that the studies haven't been done. The evidence is not there. And so in that setting, it becomes especially important for the physician to be able to use his or her best professional judgment to take the preferred drug list for what it's worth, advice, an analysis, but to keep the prerogative of being able to ultimately make the decision.
Yeah. I think you raise an important point here, and by looking at 1,000 white sheep, you haven't proven there's no black sheep, the lesson first day in a stat course. But the issue is your underlying assertion here that the physician's best clinical judgment is actually has some basis. And there's a whole lot of evidence that the physician's best clinical judgment in situations where there is no scientific evidence is essentially a mental flipping of the coin or its equivalent, which is sometimes worse. I mean, that judgment is probably no better than chance, or is. So the argument is, if there's no evidence and clinical judgment is what it is, I learned it in medical school 30 years ago, so it must be right. Why don't you assume there is no evidence and therefore start by trying with the cheapest drug? Is that not, I mean, that doesn't require the no black sheep assumption.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, there's a lot to answer in that question, and there's some really interesting and provocative points. The Wenberg studies out of Dartmouth, for instance, indicate that a lot of the way that medicine is practiced is really sort of cultural. It's regional. That differences develop out of traditions in particular areas of the country, and that you'll see incidences of surgery prescribing patterns that are really can be sort of delineated geographically. What we had hoped would happen with Senate Bill 819 was that in fact they would identify effective drugs and rank them and come up with their a scientific judgment. It really kind of astonished us when for the three of the four classes they came up with this sort of no evidence survey, no evidence conclusion. And I would agree that as a sort of a CME, a continuing medical education function, it is very appropriate and important for the HRC to put out information about what their determinations are about what particular drugs are more effective. I guess I would ask them maybe to, and they're going to do this on an ongoing basis anyway, to go back and try the task a little harder and see if you can actually come up with some evidence. Because I just can't quite really believe that they sort of came to that conclusion. So I, in a way, I'm agreeing with you that it's important to have evidence-based evaluations into the hands of prescribers as a CME function almost. But I'm not sure how useful it is. What's not useful, I think, is to communicate to the general practitioner community that some expert body has concluded that these are the most effective drugs when nothing of the sort occurred. That's not what the evidence, that's not what their conclusion was.
If I may?
Yeah, quickly,
we're
because...
Going too far. I'll get off.
All right, we're 25 minutes past this hour, and I'm in this building till 8, 9, or 10 o'clock every night. I'm not very concerned about myself, but I am concerned about staff. So if you have questions relevant to the report, prior authorization, was a Tier 2 recommendation, and these guys are going to be back. So,
we'll cover again, but this is a central issue.
And I agree with that.
But we're not going to solve it with a couple more questions.
Right.
Mr. Chair, I'll just wrap up and say I think there are some opportunities that are still out there in addition to those identified in the report to save money, and I just want to quickly highlight those.
Can you talk about four?
Yeah. Yeah, this four is attached, and there, my attachment is from the
third-party payer.
Yeah, the governor's. You want me to talk about the
page two, bottom.
Roman.
A. Yeah. Yes. The there's a bill in which is more aggressive than number 13, which would say
there will be no eligibility if you have employer-based or other insurance coverage. You're just not eligible for the OHP. So it's not pay and chase, but it's actually
no pay.
No pay, period. Requiring diagnostic codes, Tom talked about that a little bit. OMA doesn't like it, I certainly can understand some of their concern. It was in House Bill 2497. It was one of the reasons the governor vetoed the bill. Legislative Council says it's legal, and it's a way of editing out things below the line, prescriptions below the line. Hurts us, but it's good policy. Require mail order for refills of RX for all OHP patients after the first dispensing. And allow a generous, we would recommend a generous exception process for rural areas and people that, you know, that are having trouble using that. The state's mail order contract does provide for ingredient cost reimbursement at AWP minus 60% on generics and AWP minus 21% on brand name drugs. So where it's appropriate, it would seem, and we've had various costings on this, but it's kind of a no-brainer. And then finally, and this is in the tax expenditure area, means test the tax expenditure that is listed under 1.120 on the governor's tax expenditure budget. This puppy comes in 0305 at $72 million as a tax expenditure. And if you turn back to the chart, you'll see the quartile distribution of that. What we're suggesting is you consider means testing it just as you consider means testing expenditures for the Oregon Health Plan. I mean, we've obviously means tested that. The biggest user of that, not surprisingly, are people in the top quartile above $63,000 a year. That's because they have accountants and know how to do it. And it's not only not means tested, but it's not prioritized. So there's no we're not talking about any priority line here. I mean, so cosmetic surgery, whatever, all qualifies for this. And I think it ought to be put on the table when we're looking at the kind of drastic cuts we are for the Oregon Health Plan population. That's all I got, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely.
That's an interesting idea. Questions? Yes, you can...
Well, let's just push on that just a little bit, because the basic assumption is if there's not scientific evidence that drug A is any better than drug B, start with the cheapest drug.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I guess the statutory framework that we think was created with Senate Bill 819.
Okay, that's
a separate question. Yeah, that's kind of more what I'm focusing on. My sense is that the real question is, let's assume for the sake of argument that proposition is correct, what you just articulated. Where does that decision, where does it get made?
Clinically.
And I would say that clinically, it should be made by the clinician.
Absolutely. But there ought to be some... I mean, my approach would be, and it is the kind of stepwise approach. I mean, we were talking about that before, although the stepwise approach says start with the cheapest regardless of this. I mean, start with cortisone and then go to Atenolol, and if blood pressure is not controlled, move to an ACE inhibitor or something. I mean, it's that kind of a model. But the question is, when you have two drugs, physicians really are at a loss, and the information ought to be, you ought to try drug A if drug A is cheaper than drug B.
Okay.
And see if it works. And if it doesn't work, move to drug B.
Okay. Well, yeah, Mr. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, yeah, I wouldn't have had a problem if the result, let's say for those three classes that were in the first review, non long acting opioids and the other two, if the advice that OMAP had transmitted to the prescribing community had been exactly what the HRC had concluded. In other words, we couldn't find any evidence saying that, you know, one of these is better than the other. But that's not what they said. OMAP took that finding, and they said they have determined that these are the most effective drugs in this class. And that's just not what they found.
I can't comment on the original report, which I read.
Right.
I can't comment on what.
The original report, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlake, they were honest about it. I mean, HRC said we can't find any evidence, but it sort of got lost in the translation when it turned into an administrative rule, and then a communication to the prescribing community.
Thank you, sir. Time to go home.
We're still stuck on this means test or asset test.
Yeah.
Clearly it becomes more of an asset test, I think, simply because for purposes of this, it's your wages that count. It's not your investment income and things like that. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, we wanted to throw it on the table as because it is an expenditure.
It's gross income, isn't it? I mean, I get to take a dental expense out of my state tax.
Right. Well, no, I'm not sure, and I think this is a question to throw at Representative Shetterly and have him get back to us.
Absolutely.
On.
Absolutely.
But it's an idea.
We just want to throw it out as a, it's an expenditure, and it's
income.
Worth thinking about.
Well, we saw you talking to Ellen Lowe back there, so we know where this idea came from. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Don didn't get to talk much.
Yeah. He said.
Yeah. Good job, Don.
Yeah. Best testimony you ever gave. See no other business come before the committee. We are adjourned.
I want the record to note first, I didn't say isoquantitative one time in the...